than compared to $354 in February. New car prices also steadily rising, along with car insurance rates. All of it leading to a 0.3% rise in prices from February to March. Another sign the Fed is likely not going to lower interest rates in June. The next rate cut now probably won't come until September.
There's outrage over bail for a Michigan woman who allegedly drove into a child's birthday party last weekend at a boat club while drunk. Nicholas Phillips is a relative of the 8-year-old girl and her 4-year-old brother, who were both killed.
I don't understand how a justice system can give a woman like that bail.
She's charged with 2 counts of second-degree murder. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I went to go see The Queen of My Dreams, which is a beautiful film about a mother-daughter relationship. So funny, so beautiful, so heartfelt. Would highly recommend it.
And that concludes our Monday morning segment of Here's How Pat Kreitlow is an Uncultured Slob. You are cultured, man. You are a big old cup of yogurt over there. I mean, we're talking some fruit on the bottom over there.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Earl Ingram.
In Wisconsin, parents pay one-third of their income on child care. Think about what we need our income for. Shelter, food, clothing, gas bill, electric bill. And we're talking about one child. This is a crisis. Young families are saddled with what is almost impossible to deal with.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk.
When you have a fully funded, privatized voucher system, Heather, help us out.
Wisconsin has made a choice to disinvest from the public good and put money into a wholly unaccountable system and just let their political cronies laugh all the way to the bank while our kids pay the price.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
In honor of National Cheeseball Day, what food totally disgusts you? For me, it's anything where cheese is crammed together and soft. Why you would put it all into a ball or a log or a loaf, I don't understand. What about you, Conrad? You got a disgusting food?
I like tuna. It just can't be from in a can. It just has the worst smell in me. I just think it's nasty.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
This is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Women in politics are reporting a spike in threats and harassment. Mike Mohn reports.
The Brennan Center for Justice recently issued findings that detail the threatening behavior those in the political arena are experiencing now. Women were 3 to 4 times as likely as men to experience abuse targeting their gender. Erin Velarde of the advocacy and assistance group Vote Run Lead says this creates more unfairness in areas such as resource planning for a campaign.
We see women candidates and incumbents right now having to pay for security, right? Having to put in their budgets and their campaign funds and their line items, you know, for their campaigns, a security detail.
Ann Velarde says because of the worsening climate, the threats are extending to almost all other candidates, including conservative white men. She and other researchers call on party leaders to strongly condemn political violence. They also recommend that each state implement stronger protection for office holders. And Velarde says it's not just women candidates and incumbents having to deal with this behavior. Women working as top aides and political journalists are subject to more hateful rhetoric these days.
This is something that permeates women in politics, not just for the folks that are stepping up to lead, but for the ecosystem of women around them.
And if more women decide not to run or seek re-election as a result, Velarde says this means there will be fewer opportunities for gender equality in leadership positions in state legislatures and Congress. She urges constituents to send messages of support to women office holders as they weigh these challenges and their political futures. This is Mike Mohn for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, scattered showers and storms, otherwise mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 67. Rain tonight with a low of 48, showers and 58 on your Sunday. For Monday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 59.
Right now, it's 55.
Crude and Dom.
Tune in for the devil's advocates. More Trump trials in Manhattan. We'll find out who's on the prosecution's witness list. Tune in, Devil's Advocates.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly, our weekend-venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm your host this hour and next hour on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This is Amicus, a law review. We take our name every weekend from our adopted commission. And what is that? That's to conduct review, an analysis, some deliberation, some consideration, and yes, often, as today, some criticism of the recent news of our times in the areas of law and government, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice in America. Amicus, of course, as we have chatted before, is a legal term. It's derived from the Latin. It's a term used to describe a friend, often a friend of the court, when it's added to the word curiae, amicus curiae, friend of the court. That's an individual, an organization, some entity that assists some way in understanding, in offering some appreciation, some assessment of relevant issues by offering some information, by providing some insight, some perspective, or some expertise in an area that may not otherwise be on that particular platform. This is indeed our mission, our goal here on this weekly weekend broadcast. And that also involves you, our listeners, on our weekend broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This weekend, as always, inviting your phone calls, especially your inquiries, your questions about the subject matter of our broadcast. That telephone number is 844-967-2789. Once more, 844-967-2789. My producer Johnny and I are here in the studios of WAUK, but taking your phone calls from across the state and beyond about those important issues in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Again, 844-967-2789. Be a part of our conversation, especially soliciting and encouraging your questions, your inquiries, as you always do, about the things that are on our syllabus, our plan for this hour and also for next hour here on Amicus, a law review. What is our plan? What is that syllabus, that academic agenda for this weekend broadcast? When we began with the recodification of our broadcast as Amicus, I promised from time to time that I would do something called case notes. That is a little bit more commentary, a little bit more observation, a little bit more opinion from my perspective about things that are going on in those areas of law and government and justice. And perhaps this morning, not so much in a break, but in a codification, in an invocation of that promise to you, spend a lot of time offering some perspective on one of the most significant things that has happened in our nation's history. It happened just last Thursday, April 25th, we're going to spend most of this hour and perhaps next hour as well talking about a major event in the history of our nation. Not to equate this with war, but it is in many ways a day that lives in infamy. as FDR said at the time that our nation was attacked at the beginning of World War II, a day in which our United States Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, the highest court in our land, entertained oral argument in a case called Trump versus United States, a case that raises what we have described on this broadcast and in others, a truly frivolous argument, a notion that is ridiculous, that is in some circles simply described as legal craziness, completely intolerable, unacceptable under any regimen, regardless of your political animus, your political perspective, your partisan views about the world, whatever that may be, a notion that our chief executive, the President of the United States of America, should be immune from prosecution for committing crimes. And up until last Thursday, again, this day that changes, puts us on course to change American history. Up until last Thursday, people on all sides of the political aisle, people much more learned than I, people in areas of law, but also not in areas of law, looked at this issue and said, certainly, the Supreme Court is going to make the decision not to pursue and not to embrace this truly frivolous argument that our chief executive under the Constitution, under some other accepted or unaccepted policy set, some notions out there that are unidentified, would be able to commit crimes, and not be punished for those. Up until now, our Supreme Court has uniformly rejected those notions in ways big and small. And on Thursday, on what can only be described as a shocking, a stunning, a bewildering, and even revolting expression by majority members of the United States Supreme Court, seriously entertaining that notion. We're going to spend most of this hour parsing through what some members of the Supreme Court said on that majority. We're also going to be highlighting some things that the minority members of the Supreme Court said, also in abject disbelief about what some of their brethren and sistren on the Supreme Court were saying. We're going to parse through all of that and indicate along the way that these kinds of arguments made along the way by advocates for, yes, Donald Trump, these notions that somehow invested in our Constitution is a protection for the chief executive so that he or one day she cannot be prosecuted for crimes committed in that setting. That notion, shockingly, surprisingly, stunningly bewildering, is being seriously entertained by the highest court in our land. We're going to talk about all of that, the things that brought us to this point, and we're going to talk also about what could happen in a few weeks, 6 short weeks. The United States Supreme Court going to be deciding some 44 remaining cases on their docket of 62, this among them. This is not investing in the distant future. At some point in the next month and a half, the United States Supreme Court was going to tell us whether or not they are serious about this notion that executives, the chief executive of our nation, can in fact commit crimes and do so with impunity. We will talk all about that and again invite your questions. The call-in number this morning, 855-752-4852. All of that as a part of the discussion in this first hour and the second hour as well. We're also going to spend some time talking about the all-important trial that continues. We're going to focus upon some of the trial testimony, yes, in that Manhattan courtroom in which a candidate for the presidency, Donald Trump, is presently on trial for crimes in violation of New York state law. Charges against him. He is presumed innocent until proven guilty. We're going to talk this hour and next hour, more likely, about the impact of the first week of trial testimony in that case, focusing undeniably upon the key first witness, and discuss why it is that that witness was so very important in setting the stage for a jury understanding of all of that, and then talk also about some other witnesses who are on the stand as late as Friday of this past week who begin to flesh out much of that as well. We're going to talk about why those witnesses are so very credible. We're going to talk about the impact of the statements made, the accounts provided by this gentleman named David Pecker, the former publisher, yes, that's right, of the National Enquirer. We're going to talk about the candor that he brings to the testimony that he provided, the credibility, the corroboration for the account that is being provided by the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, in that prosecution. A very strong start this past week in the presentation of that trial testimony in the court in front of that trial jury. As that trial continues in the coming week, we'll also talk about the schedule for this coming week, and we'll talk about yet another hearing that the presiding judge, Judge Juan Merchan, is going to have on this issue of whether the defendant, Donald Trump, continues to violate the terms of the basic fundamental order that applies to him and to every other defendant in any other case in the United States of America, including right there in New York, that prohibits him from commenting upon and criticizing witnesses, commenting upon and criticizing members of the jury, commenting on and criticizing other members of the court staff, not including, interestingly, the judge and the prosecutor themselves, but prohibiting statements made in the public domain that would undermine the conduct of justice, the delivery of justice in that setting. And so for all of that, principally in our second hour, discussing that all-important trial, and then, time permitting, we're going to be talking about other matters that under any other circumstance on our Saturday and our Sunday morning broadcast, our weekend broadcast here on Civic Media, would take the lead. Matters related to the overturning of a conviction of Harvey Weinstein in New York by an appeals court for his sexual crimes committed with respect to women victimized by him. We would talk about that as our lead under any other circumstances, but for the seriousness of these other matters. And that too, that Tory's story as well, hugely important in not only understanding that case, but also for the administration of justice. We would also talk about what happened in Arizona this past week when, yes, charges were brought, becoming the fourth state as opposed to a federal authority, bringing charges alleging election interference, not only against people who were involved in trying to overturn the results of the election in Arizona, but also the fake electors there as a part of that conspiracy. Depending upon time, we may get an opportunity to talk about that as well. All of these hugely important cases and matters. But we begin with what is arguably, and from my perspective, undeniably, the single most important story, not just of this week, but of this year, and arguably for our time, depending upon what the Supreme Court does. I'm going to talk about the narrow possibility yet that the Supreme Court could still get this right and pull us back from the horror, if you will, that they articulated on Thursday about the possibility that a sitting president can commit crimes while in office and do so with impunity, without any response from any law enforcement. That is what a majority, 6 members of our Supreme Court, entertained seriously in this argument in connection with that oral argument, Trump versus United States of America. It is a case that goes to the fundamentals of the rule of law. It applies, frankly, to all aspects of our government. And if they follow through on it, it also presages what could be the beginning of the end of the fundamentals of our constitutional system. We talk more about that this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Here's a fun fact for you. The average chameleon can point their eyes in 2 different directions. On the other hand, the average human can't. So unless you're a chameleon, there's absolutely no way you can focus on texting and driving at the same time. So don't do it, unless you're a chameleon.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Matt Nair on air.
We Energies said the raccoon came into contact with some equipment in a substation. I just have this vision of this raccoon being egged on by his buddy raccoon going, touch them both. See what happens. Do that. Then touch that one.
They're not cute. They're not cuddly. They are disease-ridden, opposable thumb-having little trash pandas.
Matt and Air on Air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
This is Amicus, a law review, our weekend review of major stories in law, government, and the aspiration for justice. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you joining me this weekend for our broadcast. Also, inviting your live call-in to me, to my producer, Johnny, here in the studios of WAUK, taking especially your inquiries and your questions about the subject matters of our syllabus this weekend. That phone number, once again, is 855-752-4852. Once again, 855-752-4842. Or you can also text Johnny and me at the Civic Media app. Send us your comments, your questions, and we will also entertain those in this, our weekend broadcast. I promised that we would spend most of our first hour, perhaps even a portion of our second hour, because of the importance of this topic, on this major Supreme Court oral argument that the members of the Supreme Court scheduled and conducted on, yes, the last day of their oral arguments of this term. This is the 2023-2024 term. The very last day of this term, the United States Supreme Court entertained oral argument. No more oral arguments for the rest of this term. They'll begin that again in October of this year with the new term, 2024-2025. But we are now done with oral arguments in all of the cases, 62 of them altogether. They've already issued opinions in 18 of those, and we have highlighted some of those in recent times. We'll talk more about this entire group of cases that the Supreme Court will be deciding in May and in June, including certainly this major case that they entertained on Thursday of just this past week. Now, how does it come about? How does this case come about? Let's set down some foundational issues here. Donald Trump, during the course of his various litigation involvements, including especially the case that is pending against him in the federal court in the District of Columbia, the trial court there, a court that is presided over by Tanya Chutkan. She is the trial court judge. And along the way, in the prosecution of that case by Jack Smith, a four-count indictment alleging election interference by Donald Trump, an attempt not only to overthrow the results of the 2020 election, but to do so in a way that's criminal under the law as charged in that indictment. Donald Trump raised the issue that he is immune, completely, broadly immune from prosecution. And Tanya Chutkan, months ago, in a very compelling, lengthy opinion, analyzed every aspect of that argument and issued, again, a hugely compelling, convincing written order in which she rejected that notion as contrary not only to contemporary understandings about the rule of law, but also to our foundational predicates in the Constitution, things that James Madison wrote about in establishing the second article, the executive branch of our Constitution. She rejected all of that. And Donald Trump, as is his right, took an appeal of that decision to the United States Court of Appeals to the District of Columbia Circuit and said, I'd like you to review this case. I'd like you to review the rejection of my position by the lower court judge. And the Court of Appeals took that on. And yes, after a month of deliberation, much too long, but nonetheless, they too came back. Another hugely compelling somewhat lengthy, but very compelling, very readable, very digestible opinion, found the same thing. I commend to your attention, as we think about what happened this past Thursday, the very compelling, learned, thoughtful, balanced approach of Tanya Chutkan and the Court of Appeals dismissing this frivolous, completely unfounded argument that somehow the President of the United States of America should be completely blanket immunity for the things that he does in the Oval Office and arguably beyond the Oval Office in the execution of duties as the President of the United States of America. The special counsel immediately asked the Supreme Court, frankly, even after Tanya Chutkan had decided the case against Donald Trump, asked the Supreme Court to take this case on, to jump over the Court of Appeals because of the need to get a resolution of this and to get this underway so that Tanya Chutkan, who has now suspended the trial of those four counts in front of her, waiting for a Supreme Court resolution of this. Jack Smith had asked the Supreme Court to take that on. The Supreme Court early on said no. Let this go through the process and extended further the deliberative review by the judiciary. And although that decision, that procedural decision, certainly is subject to attack, certainly delays the process by which this matter gets to trial, much to the frustration of the Department of Justice and Jack Smith and many Americans who look forward to the trial of this matter in a federal district court in Washington, D.C., even though that process was not embraced, the process proposed by Jack Smith, the Supreme Court ultimately did grant certiorari, which means they did agree to review then the Court of Appeals decision, finding as well as every other court in this country has found that the President of the United States of America does not have immunity for crimes committed, took that position and took that argument on, ordered briefs which have been filed, a part of the regular process in the wake of granting a writ of certiorari, and went down this road and scheduled this special oral argument, added on this additional date this past Thursday, April 25th, to entertain oral argument on this notion. Frequent listeners to this broadcast and other broadcasts on the civic media stations know well that I and most other people in the areas of law and government, justice, who are entertained by the notion of having serious arguments about the law and about what the Constitution means, what the statutes that are passed under it means, all of us out here looked at this and said, certainly there is no doubt that the Supreme Court is going to do exactly what the lower courts have done, what Tanya Chutkan did, what the D.C. Court of Appeals did, and reject this notion summarily. And the notion behind that, the reason why I articulated that view on this broadcast and in others, was of the absolute certainty that that had to be the right decision. Not only is it implicit and explicit in our Constitution that there is no such concept set forth by our founding fathers, but if it would to be adopted, grafted on somehow into the jurisprudence of our nation, it would indeed be the beginning of the end of our republic. Because we would then be returning to exactly what prompted almost 250 years ago the Declaration of Independence, that is the rejection of a king who does indeed have, as King George did at that time, unfettered discretion to do what he wanted without any possibility of criminal prosecution. That's precisely what this nation was founded upon. That's precisely what the Founding Fathers rejected in 1776, 250 years ago, and upon which all of our jurisprudence since then has rested. 6 weeks from now, sometime in the next 6 weeks from now, it is entirely possible, based upon what we're going to talk about next, the Supreme Court may reject that fundamental notion and may indeed be setting us then on a course toward the ultimate chasm in the very fabric of our republic. We talk more about that and what the Supreme Court said on this weekend broadcast on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. In the last week, demonstrations and tent encampments have popped up on at least 48 college campuses, protesting Israel's war in Gaza.
College campus chaos as schools nationwide deal with an influx of protesters angry about the Israel-Hamas war. In our nation's capital,
Palestine will live forever.
George Washington University telling students anyone who remains in the university yard risks temporary suspension and being barred from campus.
That's ABC's Phil Lipoff at Columbia University. In the Midwest, Joplin, Missouri to Wichita Falls, Texas, all on alert for severe weather today after major storms moved through Nebraska on Friday. A massive tornado damaged or destroyed hundreds of homes in a neighborhood in Omaha. There were no deaths. Two Polk County, Florida deputies were shot in Lakeland overnight. The suspect was killed, both deputies recovering. This is ABC News.
The Brewers beat the Yankees. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers' Joey Ortiz had a big night, a home run, four runs batted in, including the game-winning single in the bottom of the 11th as the crew beat the Yanks 7-6. The home series continues. NBA, the Bucks lose on the road to the Pacers 121-118 in overtime. Damian Lillard, already dealing with a sore Achilles, also suffered a knee injury during the game.
I mean, I laid the ball in, and when I landed, when he tried to block it, he landed on my foot. The way he landed on my foot, it just twisted my knee. You know, and it was painful.
NFL, the Packers have drafted five players, three on defense, two on offense, including USC's Marshawn Lloyd, who reacted to the NFL Network calling him the best running back in the draft.
I'm the best running back in the draft for sure. And I think Green Bay got the best running back in the draft because they think the exact same. I'm super confident with that. I think Daniel Jeremiah, he's what he says. I definitely do feel like he's telling the truth on that part.
That's Marshawn Lloyd with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, scattered showers and storms, otherwise mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 67. Rain tonight with a low of 48, showers and 58 on your Sunday. For Monday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy and breezy, with a high around 59.
Currently, 56 degrees.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and a tip about how to get out of credit card debt. It's going to sound so simple, it's silly. Call your credit card company and ask them for a lower interest rate. I mean, they really will do this sometimes. Now, before you call, get your facts together. If you've been doing all the right things, you know, like paying on time every month, tell them that and ask for a lower rate. If you're going through a tough time, like unemployment, tell them your story. In most cases, they'd rather get something from you than nothing. And if they still don't budge, let them know you're thinking about leaving. Mention lower rates you've seen from other credit cards. And finally, if you really don't get anywhere with the first person you talk to, call back and, you know, try talking to somebody else. A 20-minute call could save you hundreds of dollars a year. Okay, folks, that was your Work Money Minute. For more everyday money help, go to workmoney.org. Till next time, I'm Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
The Todd Alba Show.
Luke, I'm just going to say it again. The real problem here was that goofy in-season soccer tournament that they had. That threw everything
off. What are you talking about? That was December basketball. You just couldn't figure out the rules.
You're exactly right. There are goofy rules I couldn't figure out. I don't like them.
You would not do well with driving on the left-hand side of the road.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely
not. You would just start freaking out. Yeah.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Earl Ingram.
Monday morning, join me as I stroll through memory lane and take in the sounds of the Motor City. It's Motown Mondays.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your host this hour and next hour as we talk about this momentous, cataclysmic thing that happened in Washington, D.C. just this past Thursday. That is the oral argument in this case called Trump versus United States, in which the Supreme Court was entertaining, apparently seriously, for the first time in our nation's history, 240 years of history, the notion that a chief executive, the president of the United States of America, can commit crimes and not be punished, not be responded in some way to based upon that criminal conduct. Indeed, in the wake of the oral argument, some of the more tepid headlines in America said things like, conservative justices appear poised to rule that presidents may have some level of immunity from criminal conduct. That is understating dramatically the significance of what happened on Thursday. Now, I will tell you from my own personal perspective that I fully anticipated that once the Supreme Court would entertain this, schedule this on for oral argument, this court would do what I've seen other appellate courts do, other practitioners do, when in fact they already know what the result is, when they have basically decided the case based upon the briefs, their understanding. I've had many circumstances, civil and criminal cases both, argued to the Federal Appeals Court in the Seventh Circuit, when if you stand up in front of the court and you are not questioned, you're not quizzed about something significant, you probably have a good sense that the court before whom you are appearing, the judges on that panel, have a pretty good idea, if not a certainty, about where this case is going. And usually you can predict exactly what is going to happen. And so one of the concerns that I had initially when listening to the oral argument on Thursday of this past week was that it appeared that the Supreme Court was giving legitimacy in even its first moments, even its first half an hour of nearly a three-hour conversation about this frivolous concept, giving legitimacy to this notion by the very fact that we're not simply listening quietly to an absurd argument by being made by non-serious lawyers in this matter, but entertaining seriously, seemingly cloaking this argument in some aura of respectability based upon questions back and forth and sending the first of some very bad messages to America, sending the message that this, like those other 61 cases that are out there, is somehow on the same level, on the same plane, that we are examining here interpretations of the statute, of a law, of a decision made by a lower court, and analyzing it according to standards that reasonable people can disagree on. And as the oral argument continued, my initial concern was that we are sending a message that this is normal, that this is regular, that we should simply regard this argument, like all the others, as being one on which reasonable people can disagree. And that is not the case. This is and always was and always will be, depending upon the future of our nation, a ridiculous, frivolous argument. And by virtually extending this oral argument, engaging what appeared to be academic, intellectual, university-type, law school-type examinations, sending the message, even putting aside the substance of those, some of which we'll get to, even putting all of that to one side, the notion being sent to America was there was something real here. And that's the first major problem with what happened on Thursday. It is eclipsed. It is overcome by the substance that followed. And indeed, we know what did in fact follow. To cut immediately to the chase, the takeaway from the nearly three hours of oral argument is that at least six members, certainly four, maybe five, maybe six members of the current Supreme Court are heading toward a regimen where you can discriminate against certain kinds, discriminate among certain kinds of criminal behaviors of a chief executive based upon whether or not those behaviors are classified, characterized as personal in nature, individual in nature, something that the president did in his or her personal capacity, as opposed to official capacity. And based upon that distinction, somehow, you would carve out, presumably, a set of things, a set of pieces of conduct of behaviors in an official capacity that would not be subject to the criminal law. That is a not just stunning, but shocking notion. And that discrimination, if you will, between private, personal activities and official activities is what animated much of the discussion. And it appears, once again, to cut to the tea leaf chase on all of this, that may well be what the Supreme Court is wrestling with right now, identifying if it is at all possible, and I've offered to you, it is not possible, to discriminate against and define the ways in which some conduct can be personal and some of it official when you're talking about a president who is exercising official capacity, duties, and responsibilities every day and night. Nonetheless, it appeared that that concept animated much, if not all, of the exchange. Now, along the way, to their benefit, including an exchange with Amy Coney Barrett, among the six who seem to be heading in this direction of asking the lower court to parse through this indictment and figure out which elements are personal and which elements are official, and therefore divide those out and find that only the personal matters can be the subject of a criminal prosecution. Along the way, Amy Coney Barrett and others did confirm their view that an omnibus, complete blanket immunity is not a possibility. And so they rejected that fundamental notion being articulated by Donald Trump and his non-serious attorneys before the United States Supreme Court. And that is, I suppose, the only small droplet of good news that comes from this otherwise horrifying oral argument of this past Thursday. Because we know almost certainly the Supreme Court will not adopt that. But again, reading the tea leaves, it appears that they are on this road toward distinguishing among criminal acts those that are official in nature under the Constitution, things expressly given to the chief executive in terms of duties and responsibilities, and those that are exclusively personal. Well, we know based upon our discussion on this very broadcast, concepts reaffirmed by the outstanding Solicitor General, the Deputy Solicitor General, a fellow named Michael Dreeben. Michael Dreeben. He articulated this view that this is not one of those situations, if there's ever a situation at all, where you can distinguish between those two kinds of things, they're all mixed. He described this as an integrated conspiracy to undermine the electoral votes in 2020. An integrated attempt by the president exercising official capacity things, including, for example, trying to direct the vice president not to properly certify the votes, directing the Department of Justice through the attorney general, the acting attorney general, even someone who would be the attorney general, directing the Department of Justice. Those may be official capacity exercises, but doing that plainly out of the personal interest in keeping in power, remaining in power, keeping the presidency to his own, usurping the very will of the people. And Michael Dreeben, again, this outstanding Deputy Solicitor General, arguing on behalf of not just the United States of America, not just the Department of Justice, but also reason and rationality, came forward and said that is an untenable approach. And if you send this back down, my words, not his, to Tanya Chutkan, she will not be able to parse through this because they're all integrated. You cannot distinguish one from the other. And indeed, that's the very reason why the grand jury, 26 people, not the Department of Justice, not Jack Smith, not Joe Biden, not the Attorney General, but a grand jury found probable cause to believe that that integrated conspiracy did in fact exist. And yet the United States Supreme Court, finding a way in this stunning oral argument, nearly 3 hours, to distinguish between official and personal acts, and apparently going to describe in some way, contrary to what the express argument was from the government, contrary to the best interests of our nation and its future, that indeed there is a way of doing this. Now, along the way, as I said, the Supreme Court, virtually every member, acknowledging that a blanket immunity cannot apply, but nonetheless giving life to what can only be regarded this past Thursday, at least at a minimum, as an interim victory for Donald Trump. He has got to look at that appellate panel and say, gosh, six members of that appellate panel have already said that there is something to this argument. There is something to this argument that everyone else and reason of all sides of the political aisle have dismissed as being ridiculous. Donald Trump, in the wake of that oral argument on Thursday, looked to the Supreme Court, and yes, indeed, he appointed three members of that Supreme Court, looked to that Supreme Court and said, there is a question here that these members of the Supreme Court are seriously entertaining and sending the message to America again that there is a serious question here when there is not, and indeed, beyond that, that this Supreme Court may at some point in the next 6 weeks, not months from now, but the next 6 weeks, articulate a view that accomplishes something that Donald Trump wanted, which is an identification, a carving out of some kinds of criminal behaviors by our chief executive that will not be subject to prosecution when, in fact, there is an alleged violation of law by here a grand jury. So let's get into it. Let's talk about what the Supreme Court said inside that broad rubric. We know from the start that the Supreme Court was identifying the serious nature of this. Neil Gorsuch saying, we are plainly writing a rule for the ages, and indeed, that's what the Supreme Court is going to be doing. This is the law of the land. This is not musing on the future of our nation. This is a directive of what the law is, obliged to be fulfilled and followed by lower courts, including the D.C. Court, including by the D.C. Court of Appeals, the lower trial court. Justice Brett Kavanaugh is saying this case has huge implications for the presidency, for the future of the country. Yes, it does, Justice Kavanaugh. It's going to cycle back and be used against the current president or the next president. And that's where he gets into some of the arguments that, again, are frivolous and are not meritless and nonetheless adopted by this court, at least a majority of its members, in going ahead and finding that there may indeed be a carve-out to some of this. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, again, articulating this view, further advanced by Sam Alito and others, suggesting that some form of criminal immunity, if that is in fact embraced by the majority here, that former presidents would be vulnerable to partisan warfare as their successors use the court to go after them once they were out of office. And that, Sam Alito added, could lead to endless cycles of retribution that would be a risk to a stable democratic society. What he's talking about there, in frivolous terms, is this notion that somehow we would have repetitions of something that has never happened until now, until we've had a chief executive who's engaged in criminal conduct, that on a regular basis, when every single president leaves, the following administration would then indict that person for who knows what, criminal conduct, maybe non-criminal conduct, and that would be a risk to stable democratic society. I would offer that that perspective is cynical, that the Supreme Court Justice Alito fails to understand the grand jury process, that we have people in positions of responsibility who do not bring cases, who do not charge cases against a former president or anyone else, absent probable cause, doesn't understand the grand jury process, doesn't understand the oath of office that investigators and prosecutors in the federal system, the state system, the local system take to uphold the Constitution and do it in a sensible way. And then Sam Alito goes on to posit another possibility, and that is that this very possibility of immunity would prompt a coup by the executive who would remain in office through a coup to avoid that very prosecution. Also absurd. Never before happening, of course, in our history, but positing this hypothetical for which there's no historical precedent. And in terms of the possibility.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
Most of us agree that every Wisconsinite deserves affordable health care. California mega millionaire Eric Hovde does not. Hovde said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, quote, in its entirety. What? The Affordable Care Act protects people from insurance companies refusing coverage for pre-existing conditions and stops them from dropping your coverage if you get sick. If Eric Hovde got his way, millions of Americans could get hit with increases in their healthcare premiums of 20% or more. Millions more could lose coverage altogether.
Hovde even spoke out against parents helping their kids by keeping them on their health insurance plans until they turned 26. Now that might be okay for Eric Hovde. His businesses have raked in millions of dollars in handouts. But it doesn't cut it for hardworking Wisconsinites and our families. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him we support lower health care costs. Paid for by Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
You're listening to Lake Air WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, we're talking about this stunning, this shocking oral argument before our United States Supreme Court of just this past week, this on our weekend venued review of issues related to the future of America and the administration of justice in our country. During the course of this oral argument, as we have been commenting all this weekend, we have members of the Supreme Court making this distinction between personal acts and official acts. Brett Kavanaugh saying, the president is subject to prosecution for all personal acts, he said, just like every other American for personal acts. The question, Brett Kavanaugh said, is what about acts taken in an official capacity? That is the distinction the Supreme Court is articulating, at least from the bench. And along the way, Justice Amy Coney Barrett also then says, even as she acknowledges that a blanket immunity is not a possibility, she says, can't prosecutors simply drop Mr. Trump's arguably official actions from their case? She's talking about these four counts pending in the federal district court, returned by the grand jury, and proceed to a swift trial focused only on his personal actions. And of course, Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben, again, I commend to you to listen to this man, and I must tell you how proud I was to be a former part of the Department of Justice, listening to this advocate, not just for the Department of Justice, but for you and for me and for everybody else, pushing back on that notion. He said this. He said, the indictment against Mr. Trump lays out an integrated conspiracy in which Donald Trump took the official actions and went on to say to bolster the chances that his personal situation would be advanced if the election was overturned. Again, indicating this interconnection between personal and official actions, a distinction that makes no sense. And yet, along the way, virtually all of the members of the majority appears in the Supreme Court, the six of them, articulate various versions of what Sam Alito described. That is this prospect, this specter, that somehow if there is immunity, we would have these series of post-incumbency lawsuits, probably criminal in nature, brought by the next administration against the prior administration, something that has never happened in our history. And then also that would actually encourage a coup by the very person who remains in office, afraid that when he or she leaves office, he would be subject to that. Those kinds of hypotheticals offered by Sam Alito, a justice of the Supreme Court, I would offer to you are not only contrary to our basic concepts of rule of law and justice in America, but I must tell you that I was offended by them. Along the way, Associate Justice Sam Alito engaged in this exchange with Sam, with the counsel for the Solicitor General, Michael Dreeben. And along the way, Sam Alito talked about the fact that in our country, a grand jury will indict and can indict a ham sandwich. Now, those of you who've listened to me on this broadcast on a regular basis know that I have routinely rejected that and objected to that assessment. It has been my experience that a grand juries take their responsibilities very, very seriously, that they do their work conscientiously. I did this off and on for 30 years of my time in the Department of Justice. And indeed, you're listening right now to a former prosecutor who, on more than a handful of situations, was told by members of the grand jury that they want more information, they want more evidence before they come to a conclusion. This is an independent deliberative body. And yes, on a very few occasions came back to me and said, Mr. Santel, we do not concur. We do not concur that there is probable cause. That is not a body that indicts ham sandwiches, Sam Alito. And how dare you? How dare you describe grand juries in that fashion? When Michael Dreeben pushed back against that and said, no, Mr. Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, that is not the concept. And we've got reasonable people in these positions, prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, confirmed, by the way, by another branch of government, nominated by the president. We've got people who are responsible and who are decent in upholding their oaths of office. When Michael Dreeben pushed back on that concept, Sam Alito didn't let it go. And he said, well, an eclipse happens from time to time, due, meaning every so often, maybe the grand jury does get it right. That is cynicism of the highest order. And it concerns me greatly, that from him and from others on the bench, we have that sense of our government that is not responsible, that will be acting in a way that will not only be contrary to the best interests of our nation, but contrary to the oath of office, contrary to the Constitution itself. Now, along the way, yes, indeed, we had three members of the Supreme Court who pushed back on all of this, pushed back on the Neil Gorsuches, pushed back on the Amy Coney Barretts, pushed back on the Sam Alitos, and said, wait, you can't be serious about this. Isn't the greater concern that we will have someone in the office who engage in criminal acts? Ketanji Brown Jackson, among the other two on the bench, appeared most concerned that if presidents were in fact shielded by this kind of immunity of any kind, whether there's a distinction between official or otherwise, they would be unbounded by the law and could turn, as she said, the Oval Office into what she described as the seat of criminality. The seat of criminality. And contrary to what Sam Alito said about risking a stable democratic society, it was Sonia Sotomayor who took that up and said just the opposite, that if you want a stable and democratic society, you need necessarily to ensure that everyone is subject to law, that no one is above the law. Michael Dreeben picking up on this same theme, envisioning just the opposite scenarios of what six members of the Supreme Court were articulating. Mr. Dreeben worrying about that any form of blanket immunity, or even less than that, would place presidents entirely outside of the realm of the rule of law and encourage them, as he said, to commit crimes, including bribery and treason and sedition and even murder with impunity. And stunningly, when some members of the Supreme Court quizzed John Sauer, who is representing the defendant, Donald Trump, in this matter, on whether or not those kinds of criminality, that kind of behavior, could in fact be committed by a sitting president with impunity, he refused to say that there would be prosecutions. And from his view, indeed, that the blanket immunity for which he was advocating would permit that kind of violent crime, including murder, including sedition, bribery, and treason, that was a part of the reasonable, rational oral argument that the Supreme Court was conducting this past Thursday for nearly 3 hours in front of the people of the United States of America. When we come back in our second hour, we're going to take some of your calls and comments at 855-752-4842 and talk more about what the Supreme Court did and did not do on Thursday in this.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. John Minow and Jim Schmidt.
Join us on our next show. Meteorologist Brittany Merlot joins us with a look at the weather for the week ahead.
And Gary Jaswicki is in to help celebrate the 30th anniversary of the polka becoming the state dance. Don't miss it.
Minow and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Your
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.